All right, thank you, please have a seat. First, a few preliminary matters. Justice Coates will be participating in this case, but he's not able to be with us this afternoon for the oral arguments. Second, we are filming this case as a result of a request for expanded media, which I granted some time ago. You all should not take that, however, as license to videotape this or take pictures yourself. That is not allowed. So please know videotaping still pictures. Please don't record this. The only people who have permission to do so are the folks who have already asked for expanded media and have received that permission. And third, when you leave, if you could be very quiet, the Court of Appeals is in session on the third floor. They were concerned about the noise that occurred while we were waiting to come in. They're trying to have oral arguments, but we're doing so all afternoon. So as you leave, if you could try to be very quiet so as not to disrupt our fellow court, the Court of Appeals. All right, with that said, then let's get to the business at hand, which is this case this afternoon. And it is called, what is it?
Grand Valley.
Yeah, Grand Valley Water Users and Others versus Busk Ivanhoe. May I have the increase of appearances, please, starting with the appellants?
Jason Chandler on behalf of the Colorado River District.
Jennifer Delava on behalf of the Board of County Commissioners of Cook County.
Okay.
Kate Ryan on behalf of the State Engineer and the Division Engineers for Water Divisions 1, 2, and 5. Trisha Croft on behalf of the Grand Valley Water Users Association and the Committee of Irrigation District and the Water Service.
Thanks. Who is going to be speaking, or are more than one of you going to be speaking? That's certainly okay. If you do so, you'll have to divide the time among yourselves. And also, if you wish to reserve any time, you have to do that among yourselves. Thanks. All right. You all.
Austin Hamrick, the Bus Tidal Incorporated, Your Honor, and the council table is Ryan McLean.
Okay, will you only be speaking?
Just take a second here.
All right, very good. I think we're ready to go then. This is a case which has been set for 1 hour. Each side has a half an hour. And as I indicated already, if you wish to reserve any time, you need to do so yourselves. So, whoever's going to start out, Mr. Kern, go ahead.
Thank you, and may it please the court. My name is Jason Turner, and I'm senior counsel for the Colorado River Water Conservation District. This case involves the appeal of a Division II Water Court order and decree for a change in Trans Mountain water rate. The Busk Ivanhoe water rates originate in the Colorado River Basin. It consists of three ditches and Ivanhoe Reservoir, which is also located in the Colorado River Basin. These water rights were originally adjudicated by the Garfield County District Court in 1928 in Civil Action 2621, and were decreed for irrigation purposes in the Arkansas River Basin. Busk Ivanhoe Inc. now seeks to change these water rights for the City of Aurora's municipal use. The River District and its co-appellants specifically appealed the following holdings of the Water Court. The Water Court's universal legal pronouncement that Trans Mountain water, by its very nature, can be stored in the basin of import without a decree and without injury to water users in the basin of origin or export. That the Water Court could look beyond the record of the original adjudication to enlarge the scope of the Busk Ivanhoe water rights, and that water paid as a storage fee with no evidence of any historical use could be included in calculating the historical beneficial use for the Busk Ivanhoe water rights. Contrary to the position of Busk Ivanhoe, the amici, and the holding of the Division II Water Court, storage is not an implicit right of the Trans Mountain Diversion, a decreed right to store is required. This court, as early as 1900, recognized two distinct classes of appropriations for irrigation, direct flow and storage. A direct flow waterway is the right to divert water for an immediate beneficial use, while a storage right is the right to divert water, is the right to impound water for future beneficial use. Anytime that a direct flow right is not needed for immediate beneficial use, it should not be diverted and should be left in the stream for junior appropriators. This court and the Handy Ditch Company, the Gurley Irrigation Company, 286-481 at 482, stated that storage of a direct flow right unlawfully extends or enlarges the plaintiff's appropriation for direct irrigation to the detriment of junior appropriators.
Well, don't we have a problem, though, that the Water Court found with regard to the adjudication statutes, the pre-1943 statutes? It seemed like the Garfield Court went up to the divide and then maybe felt that the judge didn't have authority to determine what happens once the water is introduced into the tunnel. So would you review for us why it was error for the Water Court to take evidence as to what the legal authority and what the intent was with regard to that particular decree? After all, it was storage and there was direct flow on the west side.
Mm-hmm.
So I assume what you're alluding to is no storage on the east side. So would you give us the legal context and then why the trial court was wrong or the Water Court was wrong in interpreting that decree and its intent?
Sure. We think that the jurisdictional argument is a little bit of a red herring. The Garfield County District Court, under Section 1752 of the 1921 adjudication laws, had exclusive jurisdiction to determine how water molecules from that water district would be used, and it did so in this decree, and when it decreed them for irrigation in the Arkansas River Basin. Fine, I'm a little bit curious to reliance on Section 1755, which said that only the owner of a reservoir could get a storage right. And I believe that's the argument that Bus Guiding Boats made and that the court adopted. It seems a little bit curious to us that if you didn't own a reservoir, you somehow got a pass and didn't need to get a decree. We think that the more reasonable interpretation of that statute was if you didn't own a reservoir, then you could not get a decreed right to store. And that's what happened in this case. There was no decreed right to store on the east slope.
But there were some, it was deemed to be supplemental water. I mean, what does that mean? And what does it mean when there was handwritten scratch out of direct irrigation to direct flow in that decree itself?
Sure. With regards to it being a supplemental supply, we don't believe that supplemental supply absolutely has to include storage. Supplemental supply simply means that you are adding water to an inadequate supply. It's important to remember when this water right was decreed, it was decreed for, I think it was roughly 80,000 acres up and down the Arkansas River Valley. It was not decreed for any specific ditch. It was leased to and then originally and purchased by the Rocky Ford High Line, but just because the Rocky Ford High Line couldn't use it all on a direct flow basis, we don't believe that it couldn't have been used throughout the Arkansas Valley by other ditches as a supplemental supply.
So your position is that could happen anywhere up and down the Arkansas, but it could not be stored to enable that to happen.
That is our position.
And what do you base that on?
That this court has distinguished between direct flow rights and storage rights as early as 1900, and there's a lot of case law, and the reason for that is because it expands the use of the water right. You know, there are practical implications here. If the Division II Water Court is correct, and no decree is necessary for the storage of Trans Mountain water rights, there is really nothing to limit those water rights other than the physical supply. In essence, a Trans Mountain River can build one reservoir and build another reservoir and another reservoir without a decree and continue to take water to the detriment of those on the west slope that rely on it. And Justice, I think you also had a second question about the decree itself and the...
Yeah, there's some interlineations in there was interesting. I mean, the Water Court had to construe a document that had some handwritten notations on it. So would you take us through that, what you think?
Absolutely.
That meant, and why the Water Court isn't right in concluding that the court was authorizing direct flow and not just running it into particular irrigation ditches down the Arkansas?
Our reading of that is where I believe it said direct irrigation, which is crossed out, and a direct flow is written above it. And we think that's actually completely logical, because these water rights were decreed for either being taken directly through the tunnel for releasing the Arkansas River, or for being stored in Ivanhoe Reservoir on the West Slope. And if you'll note, all of those places where it says direct flow, those are the water rights that can be taken by direct flow through the tunnel and released into the Arkansas River Basin. It's true that Trans Mountain water is unique in the basin of import, but it's not that unique in the basin of export. This is codified at 3782.106 that, you know, the appropriator of the Trans Mountain diversion has the right to reuse that water to extension in the basin of import. And that means those junior appropriators in the basin of import cannot rely on those continued diversions and don't have any right to those return flows. But 3782.106 also says that right of reuse is conditioned on the fact whether or not that water had been lawfully introduced. And we think a key issue in this case is whether that water had been lawfully introduced consistent with the decree entered by the Garfield County District Court in CA 2621. So after the Division II Water Court made its universal pronouncement that no storage was necessary for a Trans Mountain water right, they went on to look at the Busk Island Lake Cree specifically and found it to be silent. We will admit that the decree does not mention East Slope storage, but we do not find it to be silent with regards to how that water was to be used. It goes into very great detail about how the water will be collected on the West Slope, taken through the tunnel, and delivered into the Arkansas River Basin, where it will be taken out by irrigators below. It's wholly consistent with the original appropriators, the Carltons, stating a plain and math and filing statement, where they said exactly the same thing. We're going to collect this water and then store it in Ivanhoe Reservoir on the West Slope for later release to the tunnel, or we're going to take it by direct flow through the tunnel into the Arkansas River, where it will be taken out by irrigation ditches.
Well, what does the term supplemental mean, however? You've got storage, you've got direct flow, and then you have supplemental. Now, supplemental to what? What river conditions, what irrigation conditions, what precipitation conditions?
I don't know that we know the answer to that, what the Carltons were thinking, but I think supplemental just means supplemental. It means that you are adding to what is inadequate supply for some reason.
It could be adequate in some years, inadequate in other years, adequate sometimes of the year,
that's probably
inadequate other times of the year. So if it's supplemental, doesn't that also mean there's a base water right that it's supplemental to?
Yes.
And then you would have to determine in supplemental when you would want to use that, because you certainly wouldn't want to apply it when the base application, but presumably the native water right, is fully adequate for the crop needs.
That's true.
Well, doesn't that indicate then that there needs to be storage to make it supplemental?
No, we don't believe so. I think it proved that it was beneficial to be used supplementally by the Rocky Ford Highline Canal, but we really don't know the conditions of the rest of those ditches down there. And it strikes me that if you're talking about 80,000 acres and there are multiple ditches on the Arkansas River, that problem of water very likely could have been used on a direct flow basis to satisfy those ditches as a supplemental supply. As I was saying, that the Water Court determining that this decree was somehow silent, we think is an error, and that it explained very specifically how water was going to be used. In D-Bar Ranch v. Cotton, this court held that what's relevant is the intent demonstrated at the time of the appropriation, not the appropriator's post-appropriative intent. And what the Division II Water Court did here, despite there being no reference to storage in the map and filing statement and all of the information that was presented to the Garfield County District Court, it looked at meeting minutes from the Rockport Highland Ditch Company and looked to a map and filing statement that had been filed in Division Two for a reservoir that was never constructed. And it determined by looking at those documents, these post-appropriation, these were after these water rights were appropriated, to determine what the intent of the Carltons was in front of the Garfield County District Court. And I keep emphasizing the fact that there was no reference to storage in front of the Garfield County District Court because I have a hard time understanding how that court could confer a right based on no evidence in front of it. It seems like you're looking back now and determining, oh, the Garfield County District Court must have known this, yet there's nothing in the record to indicate that's the case.
Well, I assume it has to do something with pursuing your appropriation that you've made, you've got decreed, and that some kind of contemporaneous or near contemporaneous example of how that water, once it's taken over the east slope, is handled, might be relevant. The only evidentiary facts you might have, in fact, to construe that change from the direct irrigation to the direct flow handwritten note on the decree, and together with the supplemental idea. What would be your response to that? That, in fact, it would confirm a practice that was anticipated when the decree was entered in Garfield County.
I have a hard time reconciling that with this court's case law that specifically recognizes direct flow and storage rights as two separate appropriations, two separate types of appropriations. And the statutes recognize it. I mean, that's what we're talking about when we talk about that section that says only the owner of a reservoir. That was recognized as a different type of right than a direct flow right, because it has additional impacts. It can impact the timing, it can impact the amount of water that's taken. And with that, I'll cede some time to my co-counsel.
Good afternoon. And may it please the court. I'm Jennifer Dilala with the law firm of Moses, Whittemeyer, Harrison, and Woodruff, and I represent the Board of County Commissioners of Pitkin County. Pitkin County is appealing two conclusions of law on which the Water Court relied in selecting the representative study period used to quantify the Buscadenko water rights. The first conclusion of law is that in the Burlington case and in the Santa Fe Trail Ranches case, this court unambiguously held that a representative study period should not include a period of abuse. The second conclusion of law is that the water court does not have authority in a change of water rights case to choose a representative study period that includes periods of undecreed use if the result would be a significant reduction in the transfer of yield of the water right. Now, as applicant's answer brief pointed out, this court reviews the water court's selection of a representative study period for an abuse of discretion. But this court reviews the water court's conclusions of law de novo. A trial court necessarily abuses its discretion when it misconstrues or misapplies applicable law. And that principle was articulated in People ex rel. Nr. in 2006 and DeLong versus Trujillo in 2001. In short, an error of law is an abuse of discretion. Because the water court misconstrued and misapplied applicable law with respect to representative study periods, this court should reverse the quantification of the Buscadenko water rights and remand for proceedings that apply the law correctly. My goal today is to address any questions the court may have about the briefing, and also to emphasize that the questions Pitkin County raises on appeal have been asked and answered in this court's precedent. Pitkin County, therefore, is not asking this court to make new law in this case. Instead, the county is simply asking the court to apply that precedent. Now, as you know from the supplemental authority that both Pitkin County and Buscadenko brought to your attention, The General Assembly recently did make new law with respect to representative study periods by adopting Senate Bill 15183. As relevant here, that change in the law provides that a representative study period must not include periods of undecreed use and need not include every year in the history of a water right. The bill applies only to applications that were pending before the water judge or the water referee as of the effective date, or to applications filed on or after the effective date. The bill expressly does not apply to applications that were pending on appeal before this court as of the effective date, including the application in this case. Therefore, Senate Bill 15183 has no effect on the questions of law before you today.
Counsel, can I just get you to stop there for a moment? So is your argument essentially that we should ignore it, that it says nothing, that we do nothing with it?
I think for the purposes of resolving this appeal, you do nothing with it. I would urge the court, though, not to take the position that this appeal essentially does not matter beyond resolution of this case. And that's because there are a number of issues in this case before you that, in fact, will survive this new law. I also would suggest, Justice Ide, that it's possible, once this new statute is applied, that there will be constitutional challenges based on challenges that the legislation is retrospective, or that perhaps a private party neighboring claims claim based on the effect on vested property interests. So as to this case, no effect.
I'm a little bit concerned about your construction of the statute, because I thought this codified the Sebelia along with justified non-use is not counted in a consumptive use determination. So I think we have an open question about that. You're apparently asking us to decide it as if this says you don't count as zeros an undecreed 22-year use. And it seems to me that if you read the plain language of it, it's when calculating consumptive use, you don't include that as a use that can be seen as anything other than having zeros for the period of the consumptive use quantification represented period picked out by the judge. So I think that's what was said in Sedalia, is that for long non-justified
right.
non-use can be included in a study period. Furthermore, it seems this statute had to do with requantification. That's the next part of it. So it seems to me that when you read these together, it's ratifying the decisions of the court, except saying if it's already been quantified, which this has not been.
Right.
The trial judge found it had not been. Then you're bound, you know. It's issue preclusion on the quantification.
I'm sorry, Justice, I'm having trouble.
I'm very concerned that I'm wondering, both sides have submitted this legislation, and it seems to me there's some ambiguity as to what the intent of this legislation is and what the intent on this case is, as it's not final. This case is pending before us, and let's say that the representative period, that there was an abuse of discretion in light of the fact of non-justified non-use, then it ought to be sent back for the selection of a representative historical period of time. So I'm sorry about all that, but you did inject that. Counsel on the other side injected it. I'm not sure what this legislation says. I am very concerned about what your position is. So what is it?
Our position, Your Honor, is that the legislative history makes plainly clear that this law does not apply to cases that were pending on appeal before you at the time, as of the effective date. The law was amended on the third reading in the House to provide this new language as to cases pending before the water judge or before the water referee as of the effective date. In both houses, Your Honor, when the final votes were taken, a representative in the House of Representatives, a senator in the Senate, got up to ask, what is the meaning of this amendment? What is the effect on cases that are currently before the Supreme Court? in both houses, Your Honor, the answer was cases currently pending before the Supreme Court on appeal do not fall under this new statute. So our position is that this just plainly does not apply in this case. I would say, though, Justice Hobbs, again, our position is also that we think the court, for that reason, because this new statute is out there, we don't want the court to say, well, there's not much for us to worry about in this case. We think there are a number of issues that, as I said, in fact, will survive this new statute that are raised by this. But our position is the legislative history, which we also submitted as supplemental authority, makes patently clear that this case does not fall under the law.
In other words, we don't need to interpret this statute. We take it as it was before the trial.
Yes, sir.
And counsel, I'm sorry to interrupt. What is your take on the new legislation? What does it do?
Well,
with respect to your argument about whether this 22-year period of undecreed views counts as zeros or simply gets excluded entirely from the representative period. Well, if this case fell under this act, how would it be resolved?
Well, the first thing I would say in response to that, Justice Marquez, is that our take on this new law is that it is a change in the law. That's why this law. This is why the General Assembly passed Senate Bill 15-183. So this is new law. And our take is that, yes, if this case did fall under the scope of the law, then the Water Court would have to have taken the period of undecreed use out of consideration, which is what the Water Court thought the law was before. We think incorrectly.
Thank you.
To return to the questions of law, as I said earlier, they have been asked and answered in this court's precedent as part of the progression of this court's thinking about representative study periods and undecreed use. The first question of law, whether Burlington and Santa Fe Trail Ranches unambiguously held that a study period should not include periods of undecreed use, was answered in the negative in Burlington, relying expressly on Santa Fe Trail Ranches. We discussed Burlington in detail in our briefing, and I won't retrace those steps here unless the court has questions. I want to emphasize, though, that Burlington did not overrule, did not modify, and did not deviate from Santa Fe Trail Ranches. Instead, Burlington expressly relied on Santa Fe Trail Ranches' foundational principle that an undecreed change cannot be the basis of the quantification of a waterway for change purposes. Burlington, therefore, was not an outlier in the progression of this court's thinking about representative study periods and undecreed use. Instead, it was the next logical step.
So what is the representative historical period of time that should have been used by the trial judge in this case?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that the question that we've brought to you, this court, as you said in the Sedalia opinion, this court's role is not to make factual findings for the water court. So we're not asking you to tell the water court what the representative study period should have been. As I think you would have gathered from our briefing, the West Slope opposers at trial argued for a representative study period that came up to 2009. But that's not what we're asking you to tell the water court here. We simply want, all the county is asking here, is for the law to be applied correctly. And we think, Justice Hobbs, you brought up the opinion in Sedalia. We think that the Sedalia opinion actually is a pretty good model for what this court can tell the water court. If you find an abuse of discretion, reverse the quantification and send it back to the water court, then instruct the water court that if, in fact, this period of undecreed use is, as the court said in Sedalia, unjustified, then consider whether that period appropriately belongs in this water rights, study period for this water right. And I'd like to reserve the rest of my time in this court session.
You may do so. Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Austin Hamrick. I'm representing Muskai and Ho Incorporated, a ditch company that is wholly owned by the City of Aurora. This case is a change of Trans Mountain Water Rights. Upholding the water court in this case does not require you to decide anything that you have not already decided. This court has consistently treated Trans Mountain Water Rights very differently than Native Water Rights. You have said that Trans Mountain Water is not considered part of the natural stream in the Basin of Importation, and it is not regulated entirely within the prior appropriation system. On the other hand, you've also said one cannot expand a water right. With that foundation, the resolution of this case turns on four facts found by the water court. First, that the Carlton brothers, the appropriators of these water rights, had the intent to store this water on the east slope at the time they appropriated the water rights. Second, these water rights were never expanded. Third, payment of storage fees, rental fees for storage space in east slope residents using part of the water diverted through the Buscavano system was necessary to accomplish the beneficial use for which the water had been appropriated. And fourth, the study period selected by the water court, 59 years from 1928 through 1986, was representative of the historical use of the water line for its decreed purposes. The water court's May 2014 order made comprehensive findings of fact and carefully applied the law as you explained it. But in the end, those four facts control the outcome of this case. The water court recognized that the proper quantification of these water rights had to begin with the intent of the Carlton brothers. What was it that they appropriated? My colleague, Mr. Turner, suggested that if storage on East Slope was allowed, there would be no governing principle limiting this appropriation. I submit to you that the appropriator's intent is the principle that we're looking for. And the uncontroverted evidence in this case was that before the appropriators ever filed a petition or statement of claim in Civil Action 2621, they had already been importing and storing Muskai water on the East Slope. They had already been leasing what they termed storage water to the Rocky Ford Highline Canal. And they had already filed with the state engineer a map and statement for the construction of an East Slope reservoir. Now, they were never able to get that reservoir built, but they clearly had the intent to store it on the East Slope. More important is the fact that conceptually, this Trans Mountain Diversion System was a pretty dumb idea if you didn't have East Slope storage. The facilities for the Buscavano system are located at high elevation, 11,000 feet and higher. There's only about 6.5 square miles of drainage basin above the collection ditches for this system. By July, the sewer is melted, it's gone. The ditches are no longer running. On the other hand, what the Carlton said in their petition and statement of claim was that this water was appropriated to serve up to 80,000 acres of land in the Arkansas Basin that was inadequately supplied.
Now, you'd have to admit if we saw that today, we'd say that's highly speculative. If we saw something like that today, we would say irrigating 80,000 acres is highly speculative. Show us where it's going to go. We have attached to these briefs all kinds of Trans Mountain Diversion decrees. Some of the arguments say we should pay no attention to the amicus briefs. Others say we should. The fact of the matter is it seems that post-1943, that the entire system of Trans Mountain Diversions, Denver, Southeast, Northern, all had West Slope, East Slope reservoirs, did they not? Doesn't this one stand out for some reason for not having the reservoirs in it? And why isn't the water court correct in saying that has to do with the pre-1943 statute?
Well, as to the first part of the question, is this one unique. It is not. There was evidence entered in water court. An engineering report prepared by the state engineer's office in connection with the Kansas v. Colorado litigation, in which the state and division engineers acknowledged that there were quite a number of Trans Mountain diversions, private Trans Mountain diversions into the Arkansas basin, all of which were stored and none of which said anything about storage. When the division engineer was on the stand in this case, he acknowledged that it was pretty common in the Arkansas basin to have Trans Mountain decrees that were stored, despite the fact they did not expressly reference storage. Now, the second part of your question related to these.
I just want you to give your legal position on what changed in the 43 Act, if anything, over the prior act. It seems that the post 43 decrees all have east slope storage in them. This one does not. What's the explanation for that? And I don't know what percentage of reservoirs you're talking about that were not identified. Are they pre 43 Act or are they not?
Well, all of these appropriations, of course, were made in the 1920s. And we can debate what we think the law then, what we now think the law was then. I think probably what is more relevant is going to be what did the Garfield County District Court think the law that it was applying was. And in the Busk-Ivanhoe decree, there's not much guidance on that. However, 31 years later, in 1959, the same court, the Garfield County District Court, entered a supplemental decree for the Frying Pan Arkansas project. That decree was discussed in and attached to the Grand County amicus brief. In that decree, the Garfield County District Court in 1959 said, I cannot enter a decree for creating a storage priority on the east slope. So what I'm going to do instead is make findings of fact for future reference, by which I believe the court meant I'm going to try and nail down what the intent of the appropriator was and what the scope of this appropriation was. But 31 years after the fact, the court still did not believe it was authorized to enter a decree granting storage priorities for storage structures outside of what was then Water District 38. Does that answer your question? Getting back to the statement of claim, most of those witnesses testified that inadequately supplied with water meant that these were lands that were already in irrigation, but they ran out of water in late summer because their water rights were junior. So without east slope storage, you've got a early spring and early summer supply. You've got a late summer demand. Without east slope storage, this appropriation would be ineffective to meet the demand for which it was appropriated. You've said numerous times that decrees do not create water rights. They confirm the existence of rights that were created through appropriation. Civil Action 2621 decree did confirm the appropriation in terms of the demand on the West Slope, and that's all that was before the court at that time. You also said that importers are appropriated wide latitude in the use of Trans Mountain water that allows them to change the time, the place, and the manner of use in the basin of import, and no one can complain about that in the basin of import. You've also said that foreign water is administered independently of the priority system, independently of the system governing native water. That indicates that the storage versus direct flow distinction that would apply within the basin would apply to native water, and in the basin of export, this would be a native water right. That storage versus direct flow distinction does not apply when you get to the basin of import. The West Slope parties argue that you can't store Trans Mountain water because it might result in an expansion of this water right. Our view of the law is that it is the expansion of the water right that is prohibited. But that prohibition does not apply to anything that might conceivably result in an expansion of the water right. The prohibition against expansion does not mean that the wide latitude accorded importers is just thrown out the window.
What's hard to accept, however, is, you know, the bigger buckets, the more buckets, there's going to be no water left on the West Slope, right? The bigger buckets you build to move water in when it's not necessary, the more that you cut off any future availability of water, correct? I mean, how can it be from an engineering standpoint that you can have a number of undecreed, unlimited reservoirs that can draw for future years and store water to the detriment of those who are on notice that it's a direct flow for a particular year, right? And that you have to run through the beneficial use for that year. If it's a direct flow water right, you know, you put it on the fields that need it. And if you don't need it, the implication, Colorado law, you can't divert. You can never divert more than you need. That's an implied condition, you know, as well, in any decree. So how can it be without decreed storage, unless the pre-43 Act didn't allow that? How can it be that you can just multiply storage and call, you know, any Trans Mountain diversion whenever it's decreed to be on any vessel that you want to put on?
My argument, Your Honor, is not that they can store water without limit. My argument is that it is the intent of the appropriators at the time of the appropriation that provides that limit. There was testimony in one of the diligence cases for these water rights that the judge found was reflective of the appropriators' intent all along, where they said their intent was to divert all the water that they could get during that limited window of time when, you know, the snow was melting but hadn't gone yet, and take it to the East Slope and store it for later use. Like I said, by early July, the snow melted and the water was gone. So there's a very limited opportunity to take water, and there's certainly a very limited opportunity to expand. But I think the answer to your question is that it's the appropriator's intent that is the limitation. And the court found, the water court in this case found, that the Carlton brothers did intend to take all the water they could get through the Carlton Tunnel and store it until later in the season when it could be applied to the demand that they envisioned supplying with this water. As far as the intricacies of the 1943 Act, I mean, we looked at the statutes in effect at the time that this appropriation was made. I can't comment on how the law changed in 1943 versus sometime after. Appellants, well, the reason the Carlton brothers intent to store water, therefore, is important not because it made the storage lawful, but because it helps define the intent, the intended draw on the West Slope. It helps draw that line between what would be an expansion and was not an expansion. And the court, after having looked at all of the evidence about what the intent of the appropriator was and how that intent was implemented through diversion and use of the water, concluded that there was no expansion in this case. Now let's focus on the fact that the 2621 decree does not expressly reference water. I'm sorry, does not expressly reference storage on the East Slope. But what you have said about Trans Mountain water previously indicates that West Avenue did not need a separate storage priority to recapture this water on the East Slope because the water it was recapturing was no longer unappropriated water. It had already been appropriated under, had already been diverted under a prior appropriation on the West Slope. And once it got to the East Slope, it was appropriated water that they were recapturing independently of the priority system. So another priority on the East Slope to recapture this water would have been superfluous. The West Slope parties have not appealed the court's findings about intention, and the lack of expansion directly. But what they have appealed is that the water court essentially looked at all the evidence. We think that was entirely appropriate. You have said in at least three cases fairly recently that the water court has the authority to determine a prior decree's setting, intent, meaning, and effect. And we believe that consideration of the setting requires a consideration of the surrounding facts and circumstances. And that's what the water court did here. I would like to move on to the question of study period. After the 1986 irrigation season is when the city of Aurora started buying VI shares and devoting those shares to municipal use. The water court found that as a factual matter, 1928 through 1986 was representative of the use of these water rights for their originally intended purposes. You have said that you reviewed the water court selection study period on an abuse of discretion standard. And in our view, what the opposing parties are asking you to do is that it was an abuse of discretion for the water court not to include years in the study period that you have said cannot be the basis for a quantification. To us, that makes
no
sense.
I wonder about that greatly, because the Whitefield case says it has to be lawfully under the decree. The Santa Fe Trail Ranches case said certainly you can't substitute and claim consumptive use for diversions and undecreed point of diversion. We said that also in Burlington. In Sedalia, we said, explain why the non-use is justified. It seems to me that the logical implication is you look at the study period as the application for the change, and then you determine what's a decree authorized use and what is a non-decree authorized use, and the non-decree gets zeros. Now, isn't that the state of the law prior to whatever this act says?
Well, our reading of Santa Fe and of Burlington, Your Honor, was that you look at the matured water right, and the way this court has described the matured water right was that over a period of time was a pattern of diversion and use.
Under the decree to proration, what is the justification for 22 years of municipal use when the decree plainly says irrigation? That's what we're talking about, right?
Well, Your Honor, it was Trans Mountain Water. And what you could do with Trans Mountain Water, the boundaries of that wide latitude.
So then nobody needs to make a change ever. You can wait 22 years, you can wait 50 years.
Your Honor, we did make a change. We did eventually change this water right. The law was not entirely clear, but when the division engineer told us that, you know, we really think you need to change this water right.
The 69 Act is explicit for changes after the 69 Act, correct? And starting with Weigert, the court has long held that the representative period takes into account decree use, because other water users, other water rights holders, the West Slope, where the water's coming from, everybody else, needs to know that there is a lawful process for notifying others of a contemplated change. How can you sit for 22 years and then, in effect, only claim the consumptive use for some prior period?
Well,
isn't that run exactly counter to about 15 to 20 years of decisions by this court? You need to get your change application in there and be put to the proof if there are opposers. If not, you get a consent decree and you move on with life.
I think there may be two different issues that you're getting at there, Your Honor. One being, what do you look at when you're trying to quantify a water right? And second is there some incentive that is needed to make sure people promptly get into water court to change those water rights? Now, as to the first question, we agree with you that when you quantify a water right, you don't quantify it based on undecreed use. That's why we argued to the water court that it should end the study period in 1986, the last year of the use of these water rights for their decreed use of you know, irrigation purposes. So we think that's entirely consistent with Santa Fe and with Burlington, and our understanding of the statute that was just passed, Senate Bill 15-183, is that's what the legislature codified was focus on the decreed use, leave undecreed use out of it entirely. Now, as to your question about does there need to be an incentive? We think that incentive already exists. And that incentive is the enforcement of state engineer and division engineer. If the division engineer tells you, I am shutting down your use of that waterway because you're using it for some unlawful purpose, you may be without the use of that waterway for...
But here's the problem. The problem is that the appropriation is a continuing appropriation. Fort Lyon, number of other. And so if you want to diminish your use of the appropriation, you're entirely free to do so. If you don't need it, and apparently here's a right that wasn't needed for irrigation, for which an application is not made for the, not needed for that purpose, then those are years of non-use until you claim a change and put everybody on notice, right? I mean, isn't that the logical implication of this law started with Justice Ward's decision in Weiberg about historic maturation all the beneficial use. So the appropriation isn't frozen in time. It continues under the original decree date, but if you no longer need it, then those on the West Slope, since you don't have to draw as much, get to take advantage of it. They have junior rights where they can take advantage of it. You don't need it for irrigation anymore, right? Until, whoops, we're changing it. Then you go through the change process and you see if there's any injury. I think you're suggesting that there's a King's X under the 69 Act for changes that occur on the East Slope with West Slope water. I don't see how that can take.
I wouldn't say it's a King's X, Your Honor. I think there was some uncertainty about the need for a change of Trans Mountain water rights. I think it was less than clear. But the water right was eventually changed. And the water right was needed. I mean, there was no non-use in this case.
There was non-use for irrigation.
That's
that was true. The lawful decree.
But there is a distinction between non-use, as you have seen in some of your other cases, where water is simply left in the stream and others can rely on it, and use for a different purpose, an undecreed purpose. First of all, continued use, even for non-decreed uses, establishes an intent to use that water right. And for purposes of abandonment, for a lot of other things, I mean, intent has meaning, it has importance. Secondly, it changes the stream conditions. You have said that no one can rely on stream conditions resulting from an undecreed use, but in some of your cases, you have indicated that there may be circumstances where prolonged non-use can give rise to circumstances or stream conditions that people can rely on.
Let me just manage it. I'm sorry. Over here. So, this may be the ultimate rookie question, but I'm just wondering, I hear repeatedly in argument today and throughout the briefs that, well, Trans Mountain water is different, wide latitude, et cetera. Help me understand, as someone who's less familiar with this, why that should be the trump card here. Why does that sort of exempt you from these other considerations that Justice Hobbs is emphasizing? Now, help me better understand that, please.
The court has pointed to two primary things in past decisions, Your Honor. First, when a native water right is used, say for irrigation, it's diverted, it results in return flows that go back to the stream. Other people then can rely on those return flows. With a transmountain water right, it is, once it's diverted out of the basin, it's gone, it's never coming back, there are no return flows. That's one difference. The other difference that's discussed in Fulton v. Bijou and some other cases is the concept that in the basin of importation, that imported water would not be there but for the efforts of the importer. And so the importer ought to get the full measure of that, ought to get to use it completely, use it to extinction, that kind of thing.
Thank you.
Justice Hobbs, getting back to your question, the water court in this case found that the use of the Busk Island Home water rights after 1986 did not result in any material change in stream conditions on the west slope, good, bad, or indifferent. And so based on that, the court said, I don't see that including the years after 1986 would survey a purpose.
Well, all I'm suggesting is that under Sedalia, the trial court may have to take another look at what the representative historic period of time is for this ongoing appropriation. It should be taken into account. I mean, in all fairness, the water court and the council didn't have the benefit of Sedalia. That case disagreed with the state engineer's position that you always count zeros. It says that the water court can revisit the representative period of historical use to the change, right? To the change if there is a prolonged period of non-use. All I'm suggesting to you is there is a prolonged period of non-legal use here, at least 22 years. Now, is it justified or not? That probably is a question for the water court on remand. But how can we not remand it in light of that holding?
Your Honor, this court has never, in a change case, applied zeros in place of undecreed use. It has, when there is actual non-use, you said sometimes it would be appropriate to include those zeros. But when there was actual use for undecreed uses, you have never included those in a study period. And let me give you.
I think you're talking about the abandonment doctrine, frankly.
You
know, I think we said in Justice Hood's recently offered case
that was
that. You know, that was, you have to divert under your decree, right? If you want to not divert under your decree, you have to go through a change procedure.
That was not a change case, Your Honor. That was an injunction action. But let me give you an example that will show you, I think, the difference between the position taken by the opposing parties in this case and what you did in Burlington, for example. Let's say you had a water right that was appropriated for use on 1,000 acres. And then the water right gets expanded to irrigate another 400 acres. The approach advocated, you know, the years of zeros approach would say, well, we can't just ignore that use for undecreed purposes. That has to be taken into account, but it has to be counted as zeros. If you do that, you divide 1,000 by 1,400, and you get 71.4%. So you would get credit then for the use on 714 acres, not on 1,000 acres. And that is not what this court did in Burlington. What you did in Burlington is you said, use on 1,000 acres was lawful. We're going to let you transfer that. And all this other use that was unlawful, whether it was on undecreed lands or water diverted through undecreed points of diversion, we're simply going to leave that out of the equation and not consider it. And whether it's acres or years, as it is in this case, we think that's the right approach. Focus on, I believe what this court has done in change cases in the past, is focus on the use for decreed purposes and simply leave undecreed use out of the equation, not base it on this ratio between the amount of decreed use to the amount of undecreed use. That is at least my understanding of what you've done in the past. With regard to Senate Bill 183, I mean, this court construes statutes based on their plain language, and if they're not ambiguous, that's what you do. Our understanding of Senate Bill 183 was that it confirmed our understanding of what you said in Santa Fe and in Burlington. It flatly stated the study period must not include undecreed use. That's saying leave out the years, not just leave out the diversions in certain years. With regard to potential...
Do we need to reach this statute and construe it in this case? I mean, do you agree that this is a free, this statute, let the statute be applied in the next case, the pending case in the water court?
Well...
Do you agree or disagree with this? Do you want the court to construe the statute?
Interestingly, I agree with my colleagues, but I come up with a completely different conclusion. We believe that it would make no difference that, well, we believe this codified what we thought you had said in Santa Fe and Burlington. However, it says the act applies to applications pending on or after the effective date. That means
If you remanded this case to the water court, it would again be pending after the date of the effective date of the statute. The water court would, again, would be compelled to reach the second time the same conclusion it reached the first time. But we believe you could uphold the water court based on your prior precedent without acknowledging the statute, if we agree on the meaning of your prior precedent.
I'm sorry, I think your time is up.
So it is.
Thank you.
Thank you. We ask you to uphold the water court.
Rebuttal, Mr. Turner?
Thank you, Chief Justice. As Mr. Hammer was up here, he's talking about no injury. And we believe that the factual findings of the Division II Water Court regarding no injury were premised on its faulty conclusion that storage of faulty legal conclusion that storage of direct flow water rights did not require a decree. Every time that water was not needed, as Justice Hobbs pointed out, for an immediate irrigation use, they had no right to take it. That's an expansion of use to the detriment of those on the West Slope. And this court held in its 2011 Burlington decision that unadjudicated water use practices are not going to be recognized in a change of water rights proceeding because they haven't been subject to the water court notice of decree procedures enacted by the General Assembly for the protection of water rights. This is precisely the protection sought by the West Slope opposers in this case. We believe there's been an expansion of use because the storage was undecreed and they should not be able to get credit for it. The rest of the rebuttal to Mr. Lala.
I would just like to respond very quickly to two points that Mr. Hammer made. The first is that undecreed use is not seen by this court as non-use. I think this court's recent decision in the Jim Hutton Educational Foundation case tells us otherwise. The court in that case relied on Burlington and Santa Fe Trail Ranches for the unambiguous proposition that a period of undecreed use, quote, counts as a 0 year in a change of water rights case when calculating the historical beneficial consumptive use amount allocated to the water right. Second point I'd like to make is about the applicability of the statute. Mr. Henry, I think, said that if this case were to go back on remand, that it would then be pending before the water court and so would fall under the scope of the statute. The statute says that the cases that would be covered by it, applications that would be covered by it, are those that were pending before the water court as of the effective date, and those that are filed on or after the effective date. So unless this application were to be withdrawn and then refiled, the statute would not be effective. And with that, I will conclude unless the court has questions.
It doesn't look like it. Thank you very much. All right. Thank you, Mr. Turner. Thank you, Mr. Lara, and Mr. Henry, for your arguments today. And I will warn you, once we take a recess, to please be quiet. Once you're out in the hallways, the Court of Appeals is having its oral arguments. So we're in recess until tomorrow at 9:00.